Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone Tires, your journey, our passion, and by Lear, a global leader in automotive seating and electrical systems.
This is Autoline After Hours with John McElroy and Gary Vasilash, episode 334 for June 3rd of 2016, Car Sales FCA, and even more about Musk. Watch Autoline After Hours live at autoline.tv every Thursday at 3 p.m. Eastern Time. That's 12 p.m. Pacific. You can subscribe to this podcast for free by searching for Autoline in iTunes, Stitcher, or YouTube. Gary Vasilash.
How you doing, John?
Back in the saddle.
Yes. Living in Planet M now.
Oh, yeah. Planet M, of course, being the new advertising logo the state of Michigan is using, all about autonomous stuff.
That's right.
Yeah, Planet M. Mm-hmm. And you heard a laugh there. That was Elisa Priddle from Motor Trend Magazine. Elisa, great having you on the show again.
I guess I'm part of Planet M as well.
Yeah, see?
And David Welch, did you decide to be part of Planet M too?
Since I work for Bloomberg, we're Planet B. That's all we're allowed to travel to.
Well, you realize that the M is for Motor Trend, just throwing that out there.
Wow.
Oh, yes. Oh, yeah. I forgot about that. So lots to talk about. We ought to jump into it. Gary, I know you had some stuff about May sales, which we just got.
Well, the question is, and I'll put this to the panel, were May sales good or are May sales bad? Did April showers bring May flowers or something else?
I think it was a little soft compared to where everyone thought we would want to be. I mean, you saw Chrysler still, or FCA still hit its,
74 years in a row.
Yeah, but they had a lot
months
of
months. Year, rather.
They had a lot
they
of
wish years
yeah. in there. Yeah. GM has been purposely pulling back on fleet, but their market share is really, they're just, it's a smart business move, but they're not making up enough in retail.
They're struggling to hit their retail numbers.
Total retail sales for the month, I think we're down 13% for the industry. So this was not a great month. It wasn't horrific, but I think it does say that it's softening up, or at least it's leveling off, and maybe leveling off half a year earlier than everybody thought. It's not bad. Yeah, it's just not great.
Right. I'll play a little bit of devil's advocate and say, first off, we had two less selling days,
yep,
which has to be factored in.
Right.
And also, there were some plants down because of shortage of parts, because of
problems in Japan.
And most people are saying we're still expecting a record year. So, yes, May was softer with fewer days and... And, of course, there seems to be some kind of global crises constantly. So, I mean, you can't totally discard that. But I do think that we are still on track for a record year and that, we're quibbling about it going down a bit. And we should be worried because we don't want to see incentives come up in an industry that's been disciplined. So we don't want to see them trying to keep artificial high levels with incentives, which were already up like 10 or 11% compared to a year ago. So that is something to be mindful of. But I don't think that it's, some huge warning thing. I think it's sort of a signal that we're getting towards the peak and that the industry just has to really be careful how they manage themselves going forward, knowing that.
The mystery to me, sticking with General Motors for a minute, is the fact that they were down all over the place. So
every brand, almost every line.
Including pickups.
Or just take Chevrolet, for example. I mean, so Chevrolet, the Camaro was down 40%. Well, I thought cheap gas was supposed to bring us all more muscle cars, right? The Chevy Impala, which is, I think, we'd all agree, a very nice sedan, down 54%.
Yeah, and the Impala, though, is that's their fleet car.
Yeah.
And they've been pulling back on that. The one to really watch is Malibu. But an Impala is a little, 4 or 5 years old at this point, which isn't ridiculously old, but that's the one. That's their fleet car. I think that's the only one they have that's in the top 20 for fleet cars these days.
Okay.
So that one I can see. The Camaro does puzzle me. I think I know the answer, and they're not going to like it. But it's a great car, but I think they went too soft with the styling on that.
Oh, interesting.
That's just my take on it, and it drives great. But it's also really small. When we had the event out at Belle Isle, I thought this thing is terrific because the dynamics are. I mean, it's dynamically improved, and the interior is so much better. But I've been in that car. It's a small car compared to the old one. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's only a few inches in length is what they'll tell you, but it feels tight inside. And I think they just didn't move the needle stylistically, and the Mustang kind of has.
Well, the sales of Silverado were also down by 12.7%.
But again, you know, Alyssa brought up a really good point, two fewer selling days. And in fact, if you added those 2 days back, we would have been ahead of a year ago. In fact, we were about 1.7% up against a year ago. The SAR did drop a little bit. We went from like 17.6 to about 17.4. I think it was a pretty good month. And remember, you know, we've had such huge increases the last 3 years, big percentage increases, that we're now comparing ourselves to an all-time record year last year.
Right, we're comparing to a record May of last year.
I think the market's really strong. And yeah, incentives are up, but so are prices. Prices are up $1,000 on average across the whole industry versus a year ago. So on one hand, they're going, hey, here's more incentives. On the other hand, don't watch the other hand as we raise the prices of the car.
This was not a bad month. It's just it's leveling off.
The growth is slowing down is what you can say.
It's leveling off, I think, and everyone thought it was going to level off later this year or next year. It's leveling off, I think, a little sooner than people thought.
Well, hold on.
Because remember, late last year they were saying, oh, we're going to hit 17.8. I think we're going to beat last year's numbers, but just barely.
I'll give you two reasons.
It's still good business.
Look, I can tell you there are some suppliers and some plants that are flat out right now. You can't add more overtime. It's an impossibility. So it's very hard to get above an all-time record. And I think that if you look back at the last 2 years prior to 2016, we always came out of the first quarter very slow. By the end of the second quarter, things were racing ahead. I think the same pattern is going to hold true. I think that there could be even stronger SAR months ahead.
And we've had a couple of months that have been stronger than people thought. So just because this one... You know, so people go, oh, well, so every month is going to exceed expectations, and this one didn't. And yet no one is worried about the full year forecast.
April was really good. March was pretty weak. And that's when you see things level off, you kind of see this going on.
Right, but May was above April. So if you're saying April was really good, I'm telling you, May was even better from a total sales standpoint. Now, on a SAR basis,
I'm not saying this is a bad month. This is just, you know, we are where we're going to be, right?
But I'm seeing headlines today that are going, whoa, car sales are way off. Sell all your automotive stock. Everything's going to hell in a handbasket.
No, but there's a reason for that, okay? Stock pickers aren't... It's not a condemnation of the auto business that, okay, these guys can't make money anymore. What that says is the growth is gone. I'm going to put my money somewhere else. There are better ideas out in the investing world that where I can put my money than GM's and Ford's dividends and, you know, what, 100, you know, a you know, 0.1 million SAR growth for the rest of the year. Mm-hmm. That's not... how investors, stock pickers, and hedge fund managers make their bonuses at the end of the year. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, people are going to walk away from the stocks, not because the auto industry is going in the can, but there's just better places to put their money.
Mm-hmm. And they've never liked the auto industry anyway. So any slight
hint. Unless it's Tesla.
Unless it's Tesla, yes.
Look, investing in the auto industry is like buying a bond, right? Because you have this, particularly with Ford and GM, you have a nice dividend yield off of that stock, and they're stable companies, and they're going to make money. They can make money in they can break even in at 10 million units, so they can print money even if it fell to 16.5. This is a solid, stable business. But if you want, you know, if you're seeking alpha and you want 15-20% returns, you're not going to find it with Ford, GM, FCA, even right. Toyota, any of these guys.
To be fair to my friends making Camaros, the sales of Mustangs are down by 24%. Not as bad as the Camaro, and they're handily outselling the Camaro. But the thing that I find...
Remember the Camaro won, 5 years in a row before the new one came out? And there was some model changeover stuff, I get it, but I'm wondering about this car. The race is far from run on that.
Sure.
But it looks to me like the new Camaro has just about ceded to the Mustang. You know, we got to wait, we got to watch it, but I don't know, man.
The thing that surprises me is there's no real pattern in this, though. I mean, you know, for, you know, sticking with Ford, I mean, the Explorer was down 26%. I thought everybody's buying crossovers.
Escape was up sharply, though, wasn't it?
5.5.
Well, look. Oh, okay. Then, or am I thinking Edge? I thought one of their...
The Lincolns, like the little MKC, I think was up quite a bit.
No, that was, about
that was down 5.5% too.
The tough part about analyzing sales by nameplate is you really have to have what went on with incentives, fleet sales, not only in that month, but in the same month 12 months ago.
Right.
You've got to know, you know, what happened with Mustang and Camaro 12 months ago. But your point that, you know, Mustang is still outselling it and they should be in full ramp up by now, that's why I think that the Camaro is a terrific car, but you know, the Mustang, you know, they might take this crown back. It was like 5 years, right?
I think you're right.
Camaro sold it.
Yeah. So let's talk about two other companies. One that had the 72 years of growth, or not? FCA and Volkswagen. So, what's your take on FCA? Big sigh.
Where do you start? There's so much to talk about there, right?
Yeah, it really is. I mean, it just, I guess maybe we can't figure out what's going to happen because Sergio sounds like he doesn't know what's going to happen. He just seems to be all over the board, which is, you know, I mean, he's a smart man, but he's, I don't know, he just seems to be sounding even more sort of desperate and scattered as time goes by. And you know, he keeps trying to convince the industry that his thoughts are what's happening overall. I mean, you know, when he says that he can't sell small cars, so that must mean that the industry can't sell small cars, and so the industry should abandon small cars in general. And
to tell the guys at Honda about that, so they had to stop the
look at Civic sales.
Yeah, right. Although GM is, you know, going to stop the Buick Verano. So I mean, you know, there is you know, so I mean, it is tough to make a small car go. But I just, you know, I worry that FCA, I mean, if it even stays together, because that's always the big question. But I wonder, you know, are they just accepting the fact they can't be a full-line automaker going forward? Because you can't abandon segments that are important in other parts of the world and be a full-line automaker. You still have to make decent small cars to compete in Asia and in Europe. And, you know, they got into all of their trouble in the first place because they were so dependent on pickups and Jeeps. And yes, that's fueling all of their profits and their sales. But I just don't know that long term that's a strategy, unless they want to become a niche player, if they want to be like a Subaru or something like that and just be a pickup and Jeep maker. But of course, that was what, when they were going to break up, those were the parts that were going to be for sale, right? So I just, I don't know what the long-term prognosis is. It just, it becomes more worrisome, I think, the longer we go on.
I can tell you, there are suppliers in the industry right now who are very worried about where FCA is headed.
Yeah, and employees at FCA who are very worried.
And employees at FCA, too, right.
About whether or not they should be jumping ship.
I know some people who have left because...
They are losing people. And I know I've had people come up and ask me if they have a future.
Well, look, there's uncertainty about what they're going to do, how they're going to make it long-term. And if they do merge with somebody, what's going to happen with the job? So you may as well go someplace that you know is a going concern and will be there long term. Look, they could be not a niche car maker, but basically an SUV and pickup maker, because CAFE these days is based on footprints. Now you do have some overall numbers you need to hit, so I think they still need a partner, but they could go that route. They could also merge with somebody. The problem is, at the end of April last year, Sergio had his big, you know, confessions of a capital junkie plan, where he said someone's got to merge, and this was a gigantic for sale sign. 13 months on, nobody has really stumped up and made a deal, and GM especially and Ford, who he really wanted to get together with, want nothing to do with that. What the Agnellis want, and you know, they own, what I think, 28% of FCA, is they want to become a smaller stakeholder in a bigger auto company. So they want to...
I don't even think that's the case. I think they want out of industrial investments 100%.
But I think at the time they started this, that's what they wanted. They wanted to be a smaller stakeholder in FCA GM or FCEAF, right. You know, whatever it was. And that's not going to come to pass. What they and Sergio wanted was somebody bigger who has scale and technology and money to essentially bail them out, mm-hmm. or
buy them out.
Yeah.
And geographic reach, too.
Mm-hmm.
And so none of that's happened. And here's the real problem is Sergio's a deal guy. And he's been a pretty good one.
Yeah.
But he can't get this one done. He's not an operating guy. FCA's done actually pretty well given what they've got. But their quality is still bottom of the barrel. There's still segments like the passenger cars we're talking about where they're just not really very competitive. He hasn't fixed any of that in the time he's been there. So he wants someone else who has that stuff to merge up with him. I get all of that. What needs to happen, because none of the big players want him, is one of the other players who are in the same situation, he's like PSA. So you merge up, you get rid of the excess capacity and the redundant nameplates in Europe, and then and PSA has no presence in North America, so they could sell their cars over here. I think Peugeot, frankly, would be a better brand than some of the stuff that Chrysler is currently, you know, the old Chrysler brands in terms of passenger cars. And their product's pretty good, and their quality's pretty good. And the Ram and Jeep stuff is very popular over here. That could be a nice combination, but it's going to take a lot of work. Sergio's not the kind of guy to
he's
do gonna that.
He's going to be gone, you know, in less than 2 years.
He's going to retire by then. Carlos Tavares is the kind of guy who could do that kind of work.
Mm-hmm.
He's an operator. He did a lot with Nissan. He did a lot going back to when Renault merged up with Nissan in the late 90s. He ran Nissan North America. He has gotten Peugeot back in the black in, what, 18 months' time?
Yeah.
In a particularly difficult environment,
right,
with, you know, French government and Chinese partial ownership and French labor unions and all that. This is a guy who can make sense of a morass like FCA, PSA. And the real, I'm not saying there's a deal going on. I'm just saying that's the kind of regional player that they need to combine with two companies who really need somebody else.
But wouldn't that basically gut the Fiat product in Europe? I mean, because basically you have so basically
other
you have
than diesel engines.
I mean, you think about it. I mean, unlike here, I mean, you basically have, you know, national car companies. So PSA, the French national car company, Fiat, the Italian national car company. They both have pretty extensive lineups from large cars down to small vehicles, and I think Fiat has trucks that PSA doesn't have. But basically, you'd say, okay, if we get rid of the redundancies, whose cars stay?
Yeah.
In that deal, and suddenly you're gonna have the Italian government involved, you have the French government
involved, and
they're gonna say no, we're keeping that sedan, no, we're keeping that mini car, no,
yeah.
and it would
the problem you're talking about is a problem that's basically 7 years old, because 2009 was carpocalypse, and you saw people justifying or not justifying capacity all over the globe and cutting things out and restructuring. It didn't happen in Europe. GM spent several years and, what, $2 billion to get rid of Bochum?
Yeah.
And you didn't really see a lot of capacity taken out in the rest of
Europe.
Only
by GM
and
Ford.
Yeah, Ford
closed.
And
that's why it's still a largely unprofitable market for everybody.
Unless you're in the luxury segment, then you can still do well. You know, Mercedes, BMW, and the like.
Yeah, if you can charge, you can make it work.
But coming back to FCA, yeah, I'm really concerned. I don't see, you know, We talked about this on After Hours 3 or 4 years ago. Are they deliberately killing off Dodge? And I said at the time, well, that's ridiculous. They'll never do that. Look how, you know, it sells more vehicles than anything. At the time, it did. I believe they're going to kill off Dodge. I believe the Chrysler brand may not survive either. I don't see any new... Okay, they got a new Pacifica. Whoopee-doo. I think they've got a new Charger coming for Dodge in 2020.
There's talk of the 300 potentially going front drive.
Yeah, and it probably will because, you know, it's on a platform that's left over from the Daimler Chrysler days.
And it's in a plant that needs massive investment. And I realize this is a year of CAW talk, so that's why we're not hearing anything on that. But, you know, I can see that Brampton plant closing instead of getting the investment it needs to keep making those vehicles.
Well,
they're not big volume anymore.
Yeah, I still think FCA in North America needs the volume at Brampton. I think you're right. It's a Canadian auto workers union negotiation year, so they're playing all these things. Oh, this might go away. To me, that's all negotiating.
But you've got room in Windsor. If they move it to that same platform, you could still make... You could move the 300 over there because they appear to have delayed the crossover that was going to be based on the minivan. So
that's
you've
right.
got... You've got room for more products.
So, you're killing the 200. Maybe you make the 300 front-wheel
drive.
Well,
you don't kill it, but you don't make it yourself. So it's not a capacity issue.
Okay, but...
You still have minivans. You get rid of the Dart.
Yeah, But I mean, you know, so you look
or you have someone else make it. You have a contract manufacturer make your small.
Yeah, you make them in China, I think. Guangzhou already.
When has that ever worked?
Have a contract manufacturer make stuff for you?
Magna
it never
does,
works.
No, but Magna does a good job in Austria.
No, that's
sounds
true.
Sounds like a plan,
up
huh?
The question.
Yeah. No, but I would argue that a lot of automakers use Magna very well. They're plant in
right,
Graz.
But those are for specialty vehicles. And so basically what you'd be isn't conceivably doing a 200 in a market, sort of a bread and butter car.
Well, except Sergio doesn't see it as a bread and butter car. So what he needs is he needs a few of them over here, and he needs some in Europe. So I don't know, why not make them in Europe?
I mean, but what good will a few of them do? I mean, when there's the aforementioned Civic and the aforementioned, or we haven't mentioned Corolla and Cruze and you know small cars that are selling in the hundreds of thousands. So what's he going to do? He's going to have a contract manufacturer make. You know, a few thousand and say, well, taking care of that part.
Look at the percentage of fleet that they do in their passenger car business, too.
Yeah.
It's pretty big.
But they probably don't make any money at it. And that's the other question. Why is FCA's margins so bad? And my theory
is... Weak brands, weak quality. No one pays for that.
Well, but...
They're the weakest brands. They have the best brand in the SUV business. Ram is a very good truck franchise. They have the weakest passenger car brands in the business.
No, I realize that, but I think what's going on here, and I have no way of proving this, I think that money that otherwise would be invested in the Dodge brand and the Chrysler brand are going into Alfa Romeo and Maserati, and they're hoping on a wing and a prayer that these can be more upscale brands that make more money. But for the life of me, I don't see where all the revenue that they got coming in is going. Because, you know, we know that the Chrysler brand, okay, they just got the Pacifica. Nothing else is on the horizon. For Dodge, nothing much is on the horizon for the next few years. These brands are going to die where they are right now. That's my concern. And then they put it into these, you know, luxury brands from Italy, but I don't see it catching on.
From a consumer's perspective, you want to go out and buy a midsize sedan or a compact tomorrow. And maybe you can't afford the Civic, which is probably the highest price in the segment, or a Passat, but you're somewhere in the middle. Are you gonna go to the Dodge dealership?
No, I don't. I wouldn't even know what they have to sell.
What do these brands stand for? And by the way, if you go on Consumer Reports or J.D. Power, they're always
the worst.
Pretty far down in quality.
But so is Jeep, and that doesn't seem to hurt Jeep at all.
But Jeeps are cool. These are commodity cars we're talking about with brands that don't particularly stand for anything because they've had such a changing product lineup over time.
But Dodge has been American muscle for the last few years, and I think that resonated
well.
Well,
part of it works.
There's no question about it.
They outsold Camaro this month.
Wow. But the minivan is a problem. If that's the only thing, do you keep the Chrysler brand just for a single minivan? Because they're never going to get rid of the minivan. That is a bread and butter vehicle. That is their pride and joy.
And it's a great minivan. I think it's
fantastic. And the one is a great minivan.
It's a minivan.
Exactly.
I mean,
does it become the sole vehicle of the Chrysler brand? And, you know, or do you switch it over to Dodge? Because they had the huge debate which way to go. And for now, they're still building the old Dodge.
But they've never figured this out. Since really, it's going back a long time now, what Dodge and Chrysler are, you really don't need both of them. There's no way FCA needs, really, including Fiat, three passenger car brands in the mass market. You just don't. But Dodge is sort of a little more, a little more raw, a little more masculine. Chrysler's a little classier. But they never had enough models that sold well in each of those to justify one brand, so you threw them all into one dealership. But it's still a really inefficient way to go to market in terms of advertising spending and marketing strategy.
Maybe they just bring back Plymouth and they just merge these and
put them all into
put the minivans and all of the muscle cars and everything all as Plymouths.
Eagles.
That's right. There's
high school buddy of mine had an Eagle Talon. He's the guy.
I still think one of the Chinese companies is going to end up buying FCA. That's where I think it's going. Hey, we've got a couple of comments and questions coming in from the audience. Roll Tide says, once gasoline hits $3 a gallon, Jeep and Ram sales will tank and the profit engine is gone. I think it's going to take a lot more than $3 a gallon.
Yeah.
$3 a gallon is
still
kind of...
We've seen higher than that, and people still bought Jeeps and Rams.
I paid $2.70 pretty recently.
Yeah. But I think his point is that if gas prices go up again, Ram and Jeep are not going to sell as well as they're selling right now. That could be a fair criticism. And then,
which is another reason why they still need small cars, even if someone else makes it for them. Again, if they want to be a viable full line automaker.
I wouldn't limit it to FCA having this problem if gasoline prices go up. Because, I mean, if you look at Ford and General Motors, I mean, crossovers and SUVs and trucks are worth selling.
Right.
Yeah.
All the cars are.
And maybe
now, there are exceptions like the new Malibu, and I mean there are some of those outliers. But I mean,
Well, that's the question. So if gas prices start to take a bite out of Jeep sales, would those Jeep owners go to the Dodge or the Chrysler dealership? I
don't think they would either.
The Jeep thing.
These people are spending $35,000, $40,000 a vehicle. If they want something that's a little more efficient, I don't think they're going and buying a 200.
Yeah, right.
I think it's a different buyer, and I think FCA would tell you that too.
Okay, Rivera Notario weighed in via Twitter. He says, is FCA really in trouble and in need of a merger? They make millions with Jeep. It's probably more than millions. Or is it just part of Sergio's ambitions? Look, FCA needs a partner desperately. They don't have advanced powertrains or alternative powertrains. They're nowhere in connectivity. Car-to-car connectivity.
They have their first hybrid coming.
They have their first hybrid. You know, they got this development deal with Google, big deal for autonomy. They definitely need somebody with the technology in the deep pockets.
Okay, but would they cease to exist within 5 years?
No.
No, they're not. This is not a company that's bleeding and at risk of bankruptcy or something like that. This is a company that just long-term has some really serious challenges and doesn't have the financial means right now to solve them, so they need a partner.
Right. Yeah. Hey, look, we should get on to other topics. We got a lot to talk about, but we got to take a quick commercial break right now. So, Carmen, let's bring up that ad from our friends at Bridgestone. Okay, now's the time of the program where Dr. Data brings up his number. So, Gary, what you got for us?
All right, so, you know, I was thinking about, we've been talking some about Japanese manufacturing. We'll talk more about this. But when we think about the automotive crisis, we think in 2008, 2009 in this country, right? But it occurs to me that if we go back 10 years before that, to 1988, 1989, that was when the Japanese manufacturers were really making great inroads into the U.S. market. And remember, they had that book came out, very controversial, The Japan That Can Say No. And they're basically saying, you know, we have the wherewithal to do manufacturing better than anybody else. So they really threw the gauntlet down. And so I happen to be looking at to see how Japanese production is actually doing all these years later. So, Carmen, can you bring up the first slide, please? So this is their production according to the Japan Automotive Manufacturers Association. So their domestic production is basically 9.2 million, okay, during this year's period of time. Okay, now, if we look at what their North American production is, it's
almost 5 million.
It's almost about 53% of what their domestic production is. Then if you look at what they produce in all markets, look at that.
18.3 million.
So I begin to look at that and I wonder, okay, is it possible that we may be seeing in Japan the first post-car industry country? Because as you see, they're going down so much while the rest of the world, they're building more and more and more.
Well, there's no growth in Japan.
The population shrinking.
Yeah, it's shrinking. Yeah, the population
the
and the
not great, and you know that market is what it is. So that's why they've pushed in the U.S., pushed in China, and everywhere else. The Japanese are very good in Southeast Asia. You know, you remember GM pulled out of Malaysia and Indonesia. Toyota's
dominates
great
the market.
There, yeah.
Right.
So do the traditional Japanese automotive companies become less Japanese going forward?
Honda hasn't been very Japanese for a long time.
Look, it's, you know,
Toyota is, but doesn't Toyota have a 40% of the market or something like that?
Yeah, in Japan, right. Exactly right.
And they're both very quick to tout how much they produce here and how American they are, and that they've got some, a lot of their vehicles have more American parts than the American ones do.
I mean,
do.
It's and, you know, true.
Honda's,
I mean, you look at
an Ohio company, and you know, they're very quick to talk about how the big change was when the engineering of a new vehicle actually moved over here, because before it would still be done in Japan, but then you could build it here. Well, even that is changing. A lot of the R&D and the engineering is happening on in
look
our part
the
of the world.
Here's Honda's Halo car, most advanced technologically car
in Ohio.
Being designed and developed in Ohio, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, designed in California, developed in
there's
Ohio.
There's Nissan, you know, which is still joined with Renault and still run by Carlos Ghosn and makes a lot of money in the U.S. selling crossover SUVs. And, you know, I wouldn't call that a strictly Japanese company by any stretch. Honda does more business here than they do in Japan. Toyota is still a very Japanese company, but...
But ever since the recalls,
growing elsewhere,
ever since the recalls, part of the reorganization was to do more in North America.
Mm-hmm. So isn't it interesting that you know we have this? We've gone within a comparatively short period of time from a place where, you know, Japanese manufacturing was just thought to be the end all and the be all, and now that manufacturing is being done, whether it's in Canada or in Ohio or in Kentucky or in other parts of the world.
Don't forget, though, culturally, Toyota and Honda are very Japanese companies. And that you know, in the way that they're run and the manufacturing processes they have and the quality and the attention to detail is still really good. Mm-hmm. They're very Japanese in that sense.
Which leads to something that I know you wanted to talk about a little bit, another Japanese company that isn't doing so particularly well, Takata.
Well, it just seems like every week we get more and more just crazy numbers on the recall. So what was it, another 6 OEs announced today? I think what was it, another 14 million? No, what was it? Oh, 2.5 million vehicles are going to be recalled. I think just in the last week, the number had grown by 15 million. And worldwide, it's over 100 million vehicles to be recalled. I mean, it's incredible. And in the middle of all of this, Takata saying, don't worry, we're not going to go under. We're not going to declare bankruptcy. We're going to be just fine. We think everyone wants to invest in us.
Don't worry, the Titanic can't sink.
Keep us strong, which kind of goes back to what David was saying about, you know, Japanese culture, because the whole supply system there where you're all in-house suppliers and automakers, you know, the whole Keiretsu or...
Mm-hmm. But right now, the vulture capitalists are circling Takata, and they see a deal to be made. KKR, apparently, is looking at buying the company.
Because the bottom line is, every vehicle needs airbags. So owning an airbag maker that does it right is good business.
And this
has also shone the light on the fact that there aren't enough people making airbags.
If something goes horribly wrong...
People making everything because they all... You had to consolidate, and so now for every major thing, you got, what, three major seat suppliers, three major airbag suppliers. For a lot of the major parts of a car, you've got a very small number of players. And, you know, these days, supply risk is a big deal at the car companies, because if you have an issue like this with Takata where it's quality, if you have an issue like a tsunami that takes out factories in Japan, you know, there are a whole bunch of things that can knock a company down for a while. You've got a bunch of car makers who all get parts from this plant or this company that are suddenly saying, how am I going to finish building my cars?
Mm-hmm.
Because, look, there are, what, 3,000 parts in a car?
At least, depends how you count them, right?
And 100 million lines of code.
Yeah. So.
But if you're missing just one of those parts, you can't sell the car, right?
Right.
So
yeah.
It's a real problem.
For the want of a nail.
Yeah, for the want of a nail, and to that point.
Right.
Or a dye in your paint.
The industry can't afford to lose Takata. There's just not enough. The others can't make it up. The other airbag manufacturers, Autoliv and
TRW
or now ZF.
Mm-hmm.
There's just not enough of them out of there.
There's safety, but they're pretty small.
Yeah. But I'm just saying that.
The other three.
Just bought by a Chinese company that closed.
Yeah, Joyson.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's interesting. In 1995, there was a big seatbelt recall. And what company was at the center of that?
Takata.
Mm-hmm. Remember when we were criticized because we were eating French fries in our cars?
Oh, yeah. They blamed Americans for the recall of shoving French fries into their seatbelt buckles.
Mm-hmm.
So this is that company, and they so deserve what else all happened to them.
But they're obviously know they're important enough that even in this incredible crisis that seems to be financially insurmountable, they fully expect to come out the other side.
David, Bloomberg had an interesting story this week about Uber and subprime financing for vehicles. Can you fill us in about that at all?
I actually didn't read the story.
You didn't read the story? No.
No.
Moving on to
something that we have read.
Okay, here's something that I was...
Stories on Uber.
We should talk
today.
About Tesla. No, you want something else, don't you?
Well, just before we leave Uber, it's interesting. The Saudi government invested $3.5 billion into Uber.
Yeah.
The biggest investment in Uber. Yeah. Biggest single investor in Uber. Yeah. In fact, Toyota just put money in them. And I'm wondering if Toyota's going, holy crap, we just lost our influence at the board to the Saudis.
Mm-hmm. Well, look, Uber is they're obviously the biggest player in ride sharing, and the conventional wisdom says that ride sharing is going to grow like crazy and that it's going to take a big bite out of car sales. I'm not sure about that. It's going to grow as a service. There's no question, because it's just so much better than taxis, and there are a lot of taxi poor towns. You ever try to get a cab when you're at a convention in Vegas?
Yeah, forget about it.
In San Francisco, Uber's great in San Francisco because it's an under-taxied town. And in New York, I rarely have a tough time getting a cab in New York, but it occasionally happens, so Uber can do well there. It's basically, right now, Uber is growing because of the inefficiency of the whole cab system. And those guys had a monopoly.
I think it's more than that. I think it's not just a lack of the cab system. I think Uber is on a new trend. It's the sharing economy. It's millennials who don't want to drive. It's fill in the blank.
I'm not sure millennials don't want to drive. I'm not sure I buy that.
Just look at the number of them.
Last year, for the first time, they bought more cars than Gen X.
Yeah.
Look, 5 years ago, everyone wrote these stories, millennials hate cars. And it reminded me of that scene from The Jerk where, the guy's shooting at him and he thinks he's shooting at the cans. And he says, this guy hates cans. and it was the total farce. So, seriously, 5 years ago, millennials hate cars.
Yeah.
At the time these stories were out, unemployment among millennials was 18%.
Mm-hmm.
Most of them were working part-time, and they had record college debt. Gee, why weren't they buying a $30,000 average price new car? I wonder. I mean, you couldn't, as free as cash was from the lenders, you could not get a loan with, working 12 hours a week at Starbucks with, $100,000.
Look, you're right. Millennials are coming into the car market. Nonetheless, when you look...
They're turning 30, they're getting married, they're having kids, they're moving to the suburbs, and suddenly they're buying cars.
Yeah, yeah.
They don't hate cars, they don't hate driving.
Yeah.
That is a load
of... But they don't like sharing their car. And that's the other reason is that they look at it as, if I'm going to invest in a car, I'm going to maybe also do some kind of ride sharing with my car. It's an investment to them, too. They don't have, I think, the attachment that we do, too, where, I don't want to give my car to anybody.
So you see,
they have no problem. They'll lend you the car the way they'll lend you a book.
So they're not moonlighting as Uber drivers to pay off their college loans. They're actually just saying, here.
Well, both. I mean, if you're trying to decide what to do, you're like, if I buy a car, I'll bet you I could pick up, a couple of thousand in doing a little bit of Uber on the side. It makes it a more financially sound decision.
Look, will ride sharing grow? Absolutely. Will it replace a lot of cars? I think it'll replace, Boston Consulting Group says it will replace 0.7% by 2025. Think about this. Uber's charging what? In some cities, I think they dropped their price to $1.31 a mile. The average person goes 15,000 miles a year. So that's what, $18,000, right?
That's pricey. But Uber doesn't face much competition
now. If you live in New York, obviously it works. If you live east of Jersey City, it's fabulous. Okay, if you live maybe in Chicago where parking is really tough, certain major metro markets, megacities, obviously this is a good solution. But those people aren't buying cars anyway. 28-year-olds in Manhattan, 48-year-olds in Manhattan are not buying cars. So, because it's $400 a month just to park the thing. And you can't get around anyhow. So, there are some really obvious reasons that it's growing. I think some people will go from two cars in the household to one. I just don't see... For a lot of practical reasons, people just giving up ownership of cars.
Is it necessary for car companies to get involved with ride-sharing companies as we've seen them do that? I mean, Lyft and General Motors, Toyota and Uber, as you just said.
I think they have to, they're not risking a lot of cash to do it. Toyota did not release the amount of money, but I know that they spent very little to get into Uber. And they're basically going to sell fleets of cars to Uber. So they're going to get a piece of the action. They're going to sell cars that will be used by people who, you know, might not have bought a car in the first place. Think about this, too. If those cars are really, if this whole thing is about utilizing the asset, right, instead of leaving it sitting in your garage or in your office parking garage all day, it's being used all day long. How many more miles does it get?
Right.
And it's that car that sold is replaced more quickly, right?
Sure.
It's not going to last.
It's going to last 2 or 3 years max.
I think for the car companies,
it's not going 8 or 10.
It's not going 11 and a half, which is what they're doing now. That's not going to happen.
So there are, I mean, and this will hurt car sales a little bit, I think. Well, you know, at least on the margin, at least. But there are some offsets to this. And that's one of them right there, that, you know, those fleet cars are going to be swapped out quite a bit. Because they're just going to get used. I mean, if it's being done right, they will be used quite a bit.
I think the car companies want the data. I think that's what they're in it for, to collect all the driving behaviors that they can possibly get.
Well, yeah, big data is invaluable these days. And also, there's some goodwill to it. There's also something, I mean, if you look like you're part of the future, part of the solution, I mean, that all rubs off. I mean, we all saw what negative, I mean, declaring bankruptcy, how much that hurt a lot of automakers. Mm-hmm. I mean, perception is a very powerful thing when people think about an automaker. So if they think that Ford or GM are part of a way that, like, you know, it's kind of like the Santa Claus at Macy's. I mean, if you actually have the audacity to suggest that you can go, you know, you can be magnanimous and say, sure, you don't have to buy one of my cars. You know, you can be part of this other thing. You are just seen as being a progressive, solution-minded company. Mm-hmm. And that's going to maybe someday they are going to look favorably on you and buy a car from you.
But, Jerry, your question was, does an automaker need to have its own ride-sharing service, right?
Or,
well, I think they need, I mean, to
or just partner.
Well, I mean, because, okay, so General Motors creates Maven, okay, right, which is basically a ride-sharing service and a car-sharing service, but
and
they're also doing it.
Lyft.
They're investing in Lyft.
But
right?
It's yeah. But Maven is basically Lyft, right?
No, because Lyft is like Uber, which is, it's a ride-sharing
right.
business.
And then you have the
app-hailing business.
Car-sharing.
Maven is car-sharing where
like Zipcar.
GM has cars at apartment complexes, retirement communities, and so forth, where the residents there can reserve these and drive it for the day, as opposed to having a driver in this Lyft car pick them up. That's the difference there. And I think GM needs to play in both of those. And look, they spent $1.5 billion on an autonomous software company and on Lyft. That's not small money, but $500 million on Lyft is not a huge investment for GM. And I think they've got to be there to, at a minimum, to learn and make sure they've got a seat at the table if this becomes really big.
Mm-hmm.
Look, you know, I lived in New York, and I would see couples with two kids going to get their Zipcar at the corner for a weekend trip out to Long Island or the Jersey Shore or something. And they walk out of their apartment with a child seat, suitcase. I mean, and these poor parents are like pack animals, walking two blocks to where the Lyft car is parked, and then they're going to strap everything in and do. People do not want to do that over and over again. The hottest segment in the car business right now is crossover SUVs. Why? Because they're roomy. Why do people need room? These are sort of an extension of the home. A lot of parents leave for the day with their gym bag and their kids' soccer stuff. They go to work, they get out of work, they pick the kid up, they drop the kid off at soccer practice, they run to the gym, they get back, they don't get home till 8 o'clock. They've been gone for 12 hours with a lot of stuff that they need and a lot of stuff that they don't want to take in and out every time they leave the car. It's an American lifestyle. These are sociological issues that sort of fly in the face of suddenly everybody wants to share a car. It's going to happen. I'm a little bemused by some of these discussions because I think that some of the forecasts I've seen were 40% of, you know, global car sales will fall by 40% because of car sharing. I think that is a big overreaction.
Yeah, I agree.
It's going to be hoverboards. Yeah. It's not going to have anything to do with cars. Yeah.
Segway is going to make a comeback.
Hey, look, we've got to take another quick commercial break right now, but we'll pick up the conversation right after this. But, Carmen, let's give a shout-out to our friends at Lear.
Lear Kinexus offers a parental controls application with geofencing that sends notifications regarding driving behavior and location, including curfew alerts, acceleration alerts, and speed alerts. All delivered to a smartphone application that includes vehicle location, driver notifications, and a report card of driving history, including notifications when predefined geographic boundaries are crossed. For more information, visit Lear.com.
Okay, we're back.
So earlier this week, Elon Musk had a Fidel Castro-like presentation that seemed to go on and on and on. And
hours of stream of consciousness. The first 2 hours, the history of Tesla, you know, and his,
he does
and his
that
mellow
a lot,
kind
right?
of...
When he did the Model 3 thing, he had to kind of give a retrospective on the Roadster and then the three-car plan and all this sort of thing.
It's the five-year plan.
But you're wrong about this, because... He needs to rehearse. He needs to go over this every time because Tesla gets no coverage. The public is completely unaware of what they've been doing for the last 10 years.
Yeah, yeah.
It's a mystery to everybody.
It's a Donald Trump problem.
And without,
exactly. Yeah,
without
only
his
they had some visibility.
Refresher course for us every time he takes the stage, people would be completely lost.
Yeah. What company is he talking about?
You look at Ford can get through an annual meeting. They can do it in under an hour.
And
Tesla has been 2 hours just of history. And with all these mea culpas in there, too, you know, oh, yeah, we've done some things wrong. Oh, yeah, we've made some mistakes. Oh, yeah, we've had issues. And we also learned that the whole problem with the doors in the Model X, it's a software issue. And don't worry, because the update is coming soon, and they will be better than conventional doors. So don't worry, buy your vehicle.
So was the big news that came out of this the fact that he announced that the Model 3 would not come with free electricity?
To me, there were two pieces of news. One was the supercharging that, so in order to keep the price affordable, in order to keep it at $35,000, you can't really give free juice for life at the superchargers unless you buy a package that goes with it. And he had hinted at this before, but this is the first time that he came out. It was in response to a question. You know, a kid who has a Model S and has got 150,000 miles on it, and he's just worried that when he goes, you know, when there's 400,000 Model 3s out there, is he going to be able to go to a supercharger? And
I don't blame him.
And that's where Elon answered by saying, we have to decouple the product from the free supercharging, or you could buy a package for life that will do it. So that was very interesting. What I thought was also very interesting is him talking about how the real potential in the auto industry isn't necessarily so much in vehicles anymore. It's in the machine that makes the machine. It's in manufacturing. And he talks about how he doesn't spend any time in his office anymore. He's just on the plant floor, and he's been surveying this, and that there's a much better way of making vehicles. Didn't really elaborate too much, you know, in the details of that. Perhaps that's still being formulated in his mind as he plans missions to Mars and everything else.
It'll be hour five of next quarter's presentation.
But it's just interesting that he's basically said that, you know, that all of the automakers who've spent the last century perfecting manufacturing have somehow gotten it wrong, and that there's a whole new way to make vehicles to get rid of waste. And there's probably some truth in it, but it's an interesting discussion. You know, do we now need to turn manufacturing on its ear, Tesla style?
Well, what do you think, Gary? I mean, you know, you're with Automotive Design and Production magazine.
Well, okay.
And here's what everyone has said. How can he possibly make 500,000 cars a year in a plant that barely made 400,000? Has Tesla figured out a way of assembling cars more quickly?
Okay, so he has the former NUMMI plant in Fremont, California, which was the joint venture plant between General Motors and Toyota. And if you remember, when we go back to that period in time, what basically happened was that General Motors just basically said, hey, we have this factory, Toyota, why don't you use it? And Toyota came in and did all the production engineering in that facility, okay? Mm-hmm. And lo and behold, what happened? The plant became more efficient, the plant became more productive, the plant had more quality.
And GM learned the Toyota manufacturing.
Right.
And it's exactly, it came from that place. Okay, so Elon's got this factory. Okay. The 500,000 or 400,000, whatever number we want to use for Model 3, he never said he would just build there. So
true.
Let's put that to the side. The other thing that occurs to me is that people at auto companies who have been in R&D for a long time, like Larry Burns, who was at General Motors, always said that one of the best aspects of going to something that was not internal combustion powered was the fact that you'd be able to vastly simplify things. You'd be able to scale things. So if you wanted, say, more horsepower, basically you could add an electric motor, right? You wouldn't need to change the line to go from a 6 to an 8 or a 4 to a 6 or whatever. Okay?
That's right.
Very easy to scale. The other thing is that
the whole nature of these vehicles, it's much more modular, right? So basically you'd have Lego blocks that you could stick together.
Yeah, it's a more simple car to build.
GM also wanted to do the Yellowstone or whatever, that project. They were going to make vehicles. They were all going to be big modules, and they were going to stick them together the way they make an airplane.
So the UAW said no.
Until the UAW.
They did it in Brazil.
Right, that was
to a degree.
Lou McCaw, wasn't
Lou McCaw.
That was,
yeah, that was, and that was Brazilian, but I think Elisa's right.
I think it was called Yellowstone.
Something like that, right.
They copied that in Germany, too.
Yeah, but, you know, if you go back to the 90s, that's what everybody, especially in the supplier industry, was talking about, modules.
Right.
We're going to have these four corners, you know, your full suspension, wheel, tire, brakes, you know, shock, boom, you're just going to bolt it right on. Never happened.
See, but the thing is if we think about it, that basically the problem is that the entrenched industry has a lot of legacy, and it has a lot of legacy facilities. It has a lot of legacy equipment. It's very expensive to change that stuff. Okay, so here's Elon Musk. What does he have, right? He hasn't made this big commitment to any style manufacturing. So there is the possibility that he could, you know, radically change things, but would that radically change the production of a Camaro or a Mustang? No, because they're...
No, you have to design for that.
It's entirely different. So you could just, you know, he could do something that would be different, right? And Faraday Future conceivably could do something entirely different. I was just talking...
That's how they've designed their car. It's very modular.
Right. So could this be done? Absolutely. You know, now is it going to be 10x improvement in productivity? Not so sure about that, but
and of course quality, because we've seen that, you know, as exciting as the Teslas are, quality is a big issue. I mean, when you've got Model X and the doors won't open and close.
Part of that, in fairness to those guys, and Elon has admitted this, is that the Model X was basically over-engineered with those seats and the Falcon Wing doors and all that.
Well, you know, look, there's a reason that nobody else in the industry has done a Falcon Wing door. It's just so bloody complicated.
And that was interesting. He also admitted he should not have put the technology he did into the X. And he said, in hindsight, I would do it again and save a lot of that technology, and it would have been in Model X 2.0 and not have debuted with all of that.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm still intrigued by this issue that you bring up, Elisa, of a new way of assembling cars. I think, and to your point, Gary, making it modular. And remember, the Tesla stuff is body on frame, which makes it way easier to do a modular approach to assembly. And I think a breakthrough is just waiting there for somebody to grab it. And to your point, Gary, if you're not invested in the old way or not as heavily invested in the old way, why not try to go do something totally new?
Right. And not even invested in terms of that you've got the brick and mortar, but also just the mindset. I mean, this is a man who is looking at a plant for the first time and you know, isn't wed to how to improve the existing way. This is throw everything out and think about a whole new way of doing it.
Project at GM 10 or 15 years ago where they wanted to make small run cars, like sports cars and just niche cars, basically using tubular space frames. And they had a bunch of people working under Mark Hogan to do it. And the Solstice in the Sky, remember the Roadsters?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Used elements of it, but not...
Didn't go whole
that
hog,
concept,
right.
Yeah, and I asked people who were in the company why, you know, they didn't really push this, because tubular space frame, you know, basically making tubes as opposed to stamping everything out, not having all those big stamping dies, way cheaper, fewer weld points, everything, and they just said, you know, culturally, these guys are metal benders and they want to stamp stuff out.
Well,
but you know,
look at the Fiero before that. I mean, again, you know, you just basically had this very simple frame and you put the panels on the frame.
Or 3D printing. I mean, maybe that.
Well,
there's a precedent for this. It's called stock car racing, where they have tubular frames like that with the body just kind of hung on top of it. And that's what GM wanted to do for niche cars, because you could lower the capital cost. You didn't have all these big stamping dies, and culturally they couldn't get their head around it. That's an advantage Tesla has. But does Tesla have the expertise to make this high volume and work out the quality issues?
There's a million people have probably sent in to the thing pointing out about how many people that Tesla has hired from Detroit and how many people Tesla has in Detroit and how Tesla has that dye shop on the west side of Michigan and you know, saying, oh, they're using the automotive knowledge. But you know, I think your point about how he's looking at things differently. I mean, look, here's a guy who's saying, gee, why shouldn't we land rocket ships and reuse them rather than just throw them in the ocean? I mean, it's just like,
Exactly. He has a totally different brain,
right.
And he's now applying it. This is what he's... It's almost like he's losing interest in his vehicles now because he's got the Model 3, so that's done. And now the big challenge is how do I make vehicles in a whole new way that makes sense?
You know, there's a great thing about Elon, and it's also a bad thing about Elon, but I interviewed him years ago, and I said, look, I said, you're going to hate this question, but people say you're a micromanager. And he says, that's totally untrue. I'm a nanomanager.
Nanomanager, right.
And so, but the thing about that is he gets involved in these details. And he also, he won't take no for an answer if he thinks something can and should work. Whereas, I think that...
You know what? Henry Ford, the original Henry Ford was the same way.
Right.
He kept telling his guys, you come out with one block for that V8 and you keep working on it till you find out how to do it.
You know who else is that way? With Steve Jobs. I want brilliance. You guys are giving me mundane crap. And he was a real jerk about it. You know, at least according to, you know, all the literature and movies.
So speaking of Steve Jobs, Elon also said that Apple's going to have a car in 2020.
Yeah, well, he was just saying at that conference, was it yesterday, I guess, that he fully expects that Apple is, in fact, working on their car, and by 2020 it'll be out there, and he welcomes the competition.
He may know something.
He probably knows a whole lot more than the four of us sitting here put together do about what Apple's going to do. But I just want to come back to this whole thing about a new way of doing things. This town, Detroit, showed the aerospace and the military industry how to do things back when it was named the Arsenal of Democracy.
Yeah.
They took fighters and bombers especially that took weeks and weeks and weeks to put together and showed them how to do it one every hour. Boom, boom, boom. Spit B-24s off the end of the line. And how did they do that? They took all the plans, got together with their engineers and said, you know, oh, look at this. How did you bring that picture up so fast? Man, I'm impressed. But they made it modular. In fact, the old trade magazine that I worked with earlier in my career, Automotive Industries, literally became a how-to manual of how to take stuff that had been designed for the military, tanks, you know, machine guns, fighter planes, bombers, and showed them how to lay it out and how to do this in high-volume production. So it's ironic that it may take
a submachine gun that was, like, based on one of the line tools?
Oh, yeah. They showed these guys how you don't need an extrusion and machine this out. We'll stamp it out, bam, just like that. And we'll bend it here, weld it here, and now you got an M50 Cal, you know? So it's kind of ironic. Here's the
time. Because this is the anniversary year of all of that, too, so the timing is...
Exactly.
Well, it's even more ironic to come back to the very beginning, Planet M, the site where the bomber plant was that Ford built...
Is now the autonomous car test track.
So a friend of mine is involved with the Yankee Air Museum, and they are... They're keeping just a section of the original bomber plant. He showed me some pictures of it last week. I mean, it's just empty, and there's nothing in there. And, I thought, what an irony that, you know, you have this that, you know, completely revolutionized the way airplanes were built on that site, and now maybe that very same site will be used to revolutionize, you know, you guys coming to the studio and leaving the studio.
Yeah, it's all going to be smart highways.
Or your robot car will take you there.
Yeah.
Okay, here's the problem I think the Detroit car companies have when going up against Tesla and the Silicon Valley companies is that the people who know how to really write code and algorithms and that sort of thing, they not only, many of them live out there and don't want to come to the Midwest. They want to stay home. So it's okay, so you can open up a shop in Silicon Valley or San Francisco and hire someone. That's great, that works. But one of the other things those people like, they like getting in on the ground floor of some startup that's going to make them ridiculously rich, and they can't replicate that. It's just like when, you know, in the 80s and 90s, all the top MBA students from the Ivy League B schools wanted to go and work on Wall Street. They didn't want to work for GE and IBM, General Motors and Ford. And, you know, you really had to appeal to somebody's love of the car business or something like that to get them on board. And it's tougher to compete, and they're having that issue, I think, luring the kind of knowledge that they're getting it, and that's why you're seeing, I think, some of these deals like buying stakes in Uber and Lyft and Cruise Automation, so they can get the people on board.
Well, you're also seeing the automakers setting up. I mean, Ford opened an R&D center there. Mercedes has had one for a long time.
In Silicon Valley, right?
In Silicon, yeah, sorry. So, I mean, the automakers have recognized they have to have...
They have to go out there. That's where the
talent is. An ever larger presence in Silicon Valley as well. And also they say, I mean, half of it is just, it's not even just being there for the employees. It's that your employees go around and they rub elbows with other people, because apparently, you know, people go and try each other's cafeterias and, and things, and so you could be sitting there with a Google guy and a conversation strikes up, and it ultimately leads to some kind of deal.
So the interesting thing, though, is that, you know, we're talking about Elon, is he's actually making something that's physical, tangible, right? And many of these other companies are either providing a service or...
Writing code.
And I mean, I think that's a big difference, you know what I mean, that... You know, it's one thing to have your office, you know, in Santa Clara County, and it's another thing to have a factory there. I mean, you know, and it's a factory. We've all been in factories. I mean, let's call it what it is. I mean, it's, you know, making stuff. And that, I think, is a big difference rather than, yeah, we'll have some hip place there and, you know, we'll have free snacks and, you know, beanbag chairs and... will be cool too. You know, meanwhile, here's this guy figuring out, okay, you know, how the hell are we going to build cars? You know, we got this giant order book. We got to deliver these damn things. Big difference.
What's going to happen with that order book?
Oh, it's not going to be as big by the time the cars
It's not going to be as big. But you know what's also interesting? As we talk about him being an innovator, I mean, in a way, he also was very innovative, and even though he didn't plan to get that many orders, it became like a giant Kickstarter campaign. I mean, suddenly he had this huge amount of money overnight that he admits
Manna
he
from
had
heaven.
He had no idea was coming. And there's no strings attached. I mean, he can take that money and buy a yacht. I mean,
it is refundable.
You know?
Right.
It's refundable, but it's not in escrow. It's not.
And I think the IRS would just remember when they probably wanted him to pay that money back.
They first announced the Model S. What did he say the price was going to be? Wasn't it $49,000?
Oh, you know, I think you're right.
Okay. Now, doesn't it start at 70?
Something
it goes up
like
to
that,
like
right.
Well over 100?
Yeah.
Okay. So if 400,000 people have put down $1,000 thinking they're going to get a $35,000 car, and Elon does what he has done with forecasts on timing, cash flow, and vehicle pricing, and he's way off the mark again, and this car goes for 50.
5 years from now, still.
How many of those people want their money back and they're not going to buy it? Because here's why. Someone who's got, by the time the Model S was actually priced and they started, you know, really getting hand raisers, the car, everyone knew it was going to be 75,000. Someone who has 70 or 75 probably has 100, okay? Because they know they're going in at 70 or 75 as a base price and they're going to add 10 or 15 in options anyway. They've got that money. Someone looking at a $35,000 car may or may not have 50 or 55. That's a big difference. It's a different market segment. That's why they sell more 3 Series than 5 Series cars, because the guy buying a 3 doesn't have the money for a 5. If he did, he would have bought the 5.
Yeah. But if he improves the manufacturing, as we were talking about earlier, then maybe this one will be closer to the price.
Sure, but we were talking about supplier risk earlier. So if you've got the tool up, how do you tool up for Model 3 volume?
I can tell you, having talked to some suppliers that are doing business with Tesla, they say it's a totally different business model working with Tesla. Now, part of them are doing it just because they got to take the risk. Here's something new. Here's something disruptive. Let's at least have a toe in the door here. But what they've told me is dealing with Tesla is very different.
Are they happy about it, or are they?
They are. I mean, Tesla's very demanding, and it kind of irks these guys. You know, you're making demands on me like you're Toyota. You know, you got inky dinky volume. But by and large, they do like working with Tesla. And I can tell you, I've talked to maybe 3 suppliers that deal with, and these are big multi-billion-dollar multinational. You know all their names. They probably don't want me blabbing around what they've told me, so I'm not going to name their names. But yeah, they're intrigued by Tesla.
Hmm. Well, speaking of suppliers, didn't they just come out that they're bought a bunch of batteries from Samsung.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Yeah, what the hell's that? Yeah. What do you have a Gigafactory for? Yeah,
what's the Gigafactory for? What's Panasonic partnership
Isn't
all
the
about?
Grand opening like July 29th or something for the Gigafactory?
Yeah, and I think a lot of the Gigafactory is supposed to be stationary storage for homes, and businesses, and power utilities.
But still, this was supposedly his answer to low-cost batteries to keep the price of the Tesla cars
down. And I'm not saying Elon can't do any of the things he says he's going to do. It's just, it's a great story because, you know, sometimes, many times he misses his targets and doesn't deliver. But the cars have been way better than anybody thought they would be. Look at all the other EV startups. They put out goofy cars or cars that had, like, Aptera was, you know, that was the three-wheeled thing, right? And then
never came to market.
You know, you had Fisker, which was a really cool car, but hopelessly impractical and terrible, you know, real quality issues. Now they've had to come back. Tesla's delivered pretty cool cars, and while they did have some quality snafus, you know, probably not out of line with what everybody else has had, and, you know, the established car companies. I mean, we've gone through major recalls, Ford, Firestone, Toyota, GM, Jeep, Takata. These have all been big recalls. You know, Tesla's had some issues, but, you know, nothing that's out of line. They did a surprisingly good job with just the basic car making over there.
Well, and they have customers who are very patient with them and who feel like, you know, that they're being treated
very
special and very forgiving. Now, I don't know if the guy who, you know, if you're one of 400,000 people with a Model 3, I don't know that you're going to get the same kind of service and have the same kind of patience. That's the other big hurdle that they're going to face. But for now, the people buying these expensive cars are being treated like gold.
Well, but I mean,
so
but part of it
is,
you know, and I think we've used this analogy before. It's the difference between somebody buying an Apple product and somebody buying, you know, if it's a computer, a PC, or, you know, a Samsung phone versus an Apple phone. I mean, it's just like there's a certain cachet that people are willing to pay more for something. And in the case of Tesla, it's clear that people are able to feel it's a good idea to cut them all kinds of slack that, you know, if they had a Chevy, they would never even imagine cutting that kind of slack. It'd be like they'd be out in front of the Chevy dealer with torches, demanding their money back.
Yeah. But are they going to be special with the Model 3? That's the question. They've already said don't expect the superchargers for free. I mean, you know, are we going to see... I think it's going to be like 5 years before most people get their car. How many other little takeaways are going to happen
between
now and then?
But the superchargers thing, I think, was genius because basically he said, okay, I'm going to have these cars and I'm going to provide these superchargers that are not only, you know, free electricity because as you guys know, you drive around here, we can find free electricity. There are level 2 chargers all over the place, you know, shopping malls and so on. You can plug in for free, no problem. Of course, it takes 3 hours to recharge your battery, but that's another question. But the thing of it is that, so he said, okay, I'm going to have this whole thing and I'm going to basically, you know, seed the ground, okay? And now he's done the seeding. Now he's had a lot of people who have bought his vehicles. And as for those who are coming behind him in volume, why would you give them free? It'd be like giving away free gasoline. Why would you want to do that?
Well, the early roadsters, you had to pay for the supercharger.
Right.
So, but they didn't sell those roadsters.
But he's already established. He doesn't need to do this because he's already created the network and so if you want to use it, go ahead.
Why? Because people who buy $110,000 Model S's, they can't pay that $2 a day in electricity charging it up.
Right. I mean, he had a great line. He said, you know, you should charge your car or you charge your phone
at
home.
That was very funny.
Okay.
So you don't go to a gas station, charge your phone.
Enough of Tesla for this show. We had some viewers who shot in questions and comments, and they took the time. We ought to get to them in sort of a rapid fire kind of thing right now. So Wright Knight said, talking about our airbag Takata thing, he says, have FCA start making airbags. Problem fixed. Okay, Elisa, I'm going to throw this one to you because this one comes in from Halifax. So, fellow Canadian, Abhi says, what's happening with the Saab company?
Sorry, with the?
Saab, as in the Swedish Saab company.
Yeah. Swedish.
Does anybody know?
SAB.
Well, they were bought by a Chinese company.
A Chinese company.
That's trying to make electric or something,
They
right?
bought some of the assets of it.
Okay.
Jeez, I have no idea.
Was it NEC or no? It wasn't NEC. It was.
It was the people that owned the little Think car, wasn't it?
Those are Norwegians.
No, but didn't the same company?
Answer: We don't know.
We don't know.
Sorry, we don't know.
Okay, I'll throw this to you, David. Bruce says, with Nissan basically buying out Mitsubishi, where do you see it going?
Look, I think they bought Mitsubishi for the pickup truck business in Southeast Asia, which is a good business. The rest of it, you know, do you need Mitsubishi in the U.S.?
If it's not in the U.S.,
no. You don't. And in a lot of markets like that, I could see them pulling back in some markets where it's not needed, and just, you know, Nissan trying to pick up the market share there. If it's not, like, if they're not making money in markets like the U.S., they, you know, there's no longer a reason to do it. But yeah, well, they don't have complete. They have control of it, but
yeah. Well, it gives them another million units of capacity. So. Yeah,
and notice, that was a good
notice
deal.
Notice we didn't spend the last 20 minutes talking about the iMEVs and Leafs.
Yeah. Right. Exactly. That's right. Okay, Gary, to you. Carl wants to know: do cars with stop-start systems have heavy-duty starters installed?
They generally have heavy-duty batteries installed. The glass matte batteries, so that's generally where they're.
And usually it's not the starter that starts the engine when you turn the key or push the button. They tend to have integrated electric motors, right? Mm-hmm. Because they got to spin these engines
right.
way faster than when you crank it up on your own in the mm-hmm. morning. So, they figured out how to make these things work. Mike from Philly says, hello, John and company. I have a question. How old are Ford's platforms? Are they left over from Volvo and Mazda? I think they're
not anymore.
That now.
Yeah, they've finally gotten through the last of them. There's no more. The last ones were the Mazda ones, and they're all gone now too.
I like some of the Mazda platforms though.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, Mazda's doing.
But they got new platforms too. So.
Yeah.
Yeah. They
Mazda's
went. They're separate
some
ways.
Really good stuff.
Yeah.
Okay. Snarky Moose wrote in to say it's 2026. You're having a holiday cookout. There's a driveway full of self-driving cars. What if the family with the nearest car with the car nearest the garage door needs to leave? I love these questions. Will these cars be able to autonomously get out of each other's way so the family can leave?
Yeah.
Or do you have to leave them in manual mode and have a human solve the puzzle?
No, I think it's a lot easier than everyone leaving their, putting down their glass of Chardonnay and getting up and moving it. Everyone will pull out their phones or whatever their commands are.
If a car
have their car move.
If a car is self-driving, you still have to. It still needs to know where to go.
Right.
Yeah. So you'd have to tell the nav system to go, you know, 200 yards.
Yeah, but you'd sit there and do it on the couch with your phone instead of getting up and moving it yourself.
And then Gary...
uses the vision system, and then it would call Watson, and Watson would tell him where to go.
Actually, you know, you'll pair your phone to your car, your autonomous car, and it will call Uber for you.
Or you just
let
get
some drivers come over. And
or just say, Siri, I have a problem. Guy. I need 20 cars to move. Can you handle that for me?
That's right.
Aren't cars going to fly by 2026?
They will just,
let's hope.
That's right, like a Harrier jump shed. Just go straight up so the guy behind you or in front of you can get out.
And just to finish your point about Japanese production, Rivero Notario says, Japanese automakers are even making cars outside of Japan for sale inside of Japan.
Mm-hmm. Well, when we saw that number of 18-some million being built in the rest of the world compared to Japan, it's just like, yeah, you got to imagine that. And, you know, and think about it. Honda has long been producing cars in the United States and sending them
exporting
back.
There.
Yeah, I mean, because Civic Coupe was always became a model that was built here.
NSX, obviously, is
right.
Going to go from Ohio back to Japan.
Hey, look, we ought to wrap it up. We ought to let everybody know there will not be an after hours next week. We've got so much other stuff that we've got to, we can't do the show next week. People are traveling. We've got another conference we've got to go to. So no after hours next week. But after that, we'll do it again.
Mm-hmm.
And Elisa Priddle, thanks so much for coming on today's show. We'll
Loved
definitely
it.
Have you back. You. David, great having you here too, man.
Great to be back.
Okay, Gary, and then you and I will definitely be back.
2 weeks.
So thanks, everybody, for having tuned in.
AutoLine After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone Tires, your journey, our passion. And by Lear, a global leader in automotive seating and electrical systems.
Visit our website, autoline.tv, where you can watch us live Thursday afternoons. Get your daily fix with Autoline Daily and in-depth analysis and interviews with Autoline This Week. There's all that and much more at autoline.tv.